Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies and how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears, we will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome back to the Fat Joy podcast. I'm your host, Sophia Apostle, and I'm so excited to be joined today by Kate O'Connor. Hi, Kate. So Kate's going to tell you a little bit about who she is, but I believe, because I always like to track back, like, how did I find you? I think I found you through Virginia Soul Smith, because you are mentioned in Virginia's book in chapter 10. And I think I had read one of Virginia's newsletters or something that mentioned you. And I was like, oh my God, I have to talk to Kate. And then here you are. So thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. When Virginia described me as like one of the protagonists of chapter 10, I was like, oh my God, I've never been described as a protagonist before. This is crazy, right? Like, especially as like, you know, like a little intro on myself, like being an English teacher, like the word protagonist, like adjacent to my own like identity is so wild. Well, it's just really cool to sort of come full circle in this work that way. Especially after what feels like a really long journey on my way here, you know?
Right. I love that that's how she chose to describe you. I feel like that was probably very intentional on her part. She's a very intentional writer. And yeah, the English teacher in you, I can just feel like the... So Kate, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are first? Let's start there.
Sure. I am an English educator from New York. I'm currently in my role as a middle school teacher. I've taught middle school, high school, night school, you name it, in the English language arts. I am in recovery from various iterations of eating disorders. And I've always been, a mental health advocate in any and every capacity imaginable. So I've been on this journey for a really, really long time. And sort of just found my way here, by noticing the ways that, you know, anti-fatness shows up at school, and not necessarily always aimed at kids, right? Like, we're always so focused, I think, as teachers on like what's best for the kids, what's best for the kids, right? Because the kids are why we have jobs. But in a profession that is rooted in so much sacrifice and self-sacrifice and the work and the invisible labor, especially of women in the United States, a lot of the body trauma lands on educators, and we don't talk a lot about that. And a lot of that meets anti-fatness in so many ways that aren't paid attention to. And I mean, I've always been really justice-minded, but I've never really seen weight stigma take up a whole lot of space in that conversation, even when, right, like the whole world had that awakening 3 years ago and white people started to care about things that really mattered, that we needed to pay attention to. Even then, right, we're still trying to anchor that conversation in you cannot talk about any of this unless you're talking about the intersections between racism, anti-fatness, et cetera. So I've come into that work via my own recovery, but also in noticing what's missing in education too.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so happy you're doing this work, Kate, because I think, this is a very obvious thing to say, but what happens in the schools really shapes our kids in a lot of ways. Like, I've had a couple of guests like Virginia, Dr. Rachel, and I'm blanking on Rachel's last name. Oh my God, Rachel, I'm sorry if you're listening. Where we talked specifically about how diet culture impacts children. And it's things like certain curriculum assignments. It's the bias that the teacher themselves may carry and be speaking to, things like healthy and unhealthy, junk food, health food. Like it's so integrated into all levels of our society. And then it gets amplified at school because these kids are being taught certain ways. And one of the things I'm very excited to talk to you about that we'll segue into after you tell us about your relationship to the word fat is just the challenge, because I can just imagine the incredible roadblocks and challenges you have had, even to just like squeak this in a little bit, because it's so rooted and the school systems are these big behemoths of like curriculum design, and there's all these layers and all this hierarchy. And in Canada here, we have very strong unions. So any little change to curriculum has to go through all these processes. Like it is a big multi-part machine. And to bring in anti-fatness, I'm exhausted just thinking about what you've had to do. So I am going to ask you about that, but I want to start with your own journey with the word fat. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I'm a 90s kid. that says a lot of it, but, I grew up with a lot of the Weight Watchers, Slim Fast in the Fridge, like the last thing you want to be is fat, right? It's the most important that you don't be that messaging in my household, in my, my peer groups, and in my own head. Right? Like the internalization of that messaging was really, really strong. And I think simultaneous to like developing an eating disorder. And like I said, it had various symptomatic iterations. Like I was binge, purge, compensate, all of it, all at once, sometimes, in stages, various stages. But like it was all about like weight control. And once I sort of dropped that rope and stopped playing the tug of war, like I started to see like the recovery beyond the horizon for me.
Can I ask, Kate, what led you to dropping the rope? Because that's such a big thing to be able to do.
I think reading a lot of, curating my social media to seeing bodies that were fat first and foremost. And I mean, it wasn't always like the quick solve, right? Because you can see it and then like see it in the mirror and not have it translate from like Instagram screen to here, because how you feel and how someone else looks are completely different, especially when you're in dysmorphia. But I think just like saturation with body diversity and like unlearning the idea that like when we're kids, we don't see a whole lot of diversity. And like, it was never really something that was like implicitly or explicitly valued. It was never just like, oh, like we have to expose you to all different types of people. It was like, if you are, then great, but like no one's going to go out of their way to show you that. Right. but like, I think the reparenting for me of like that exposure was almost like a really quick, good way in to reclaiming that. And like just even using the word beginning neutrally and then positively and seeing other people do the same was sort of like how I reversed a lot of the damage that was done.
Yeah. Yeah. And how old were you when you were kind of going through that process? Is that kind of a recent?
It was great. I was maybe 22 and I'm 29 now.
That's still pretty amazing to do that at 22. Yeah. I was like 35, I think. They're like early to mid 30s before I even like knew there was another way to live in the world.
Right. And you know, all that recovery was for me at first for a really long time was like, I don't know what's going to work, but I know this is, you know.
Oh my God, what I hear in there is so much trust. Like, what were you trusting?
Anything that wasn't going to kill me. Like, that was where it was, you know? And like, at that point, even, like, granted, like, I'm dropping a lot of names today. Like, even, like, I put my trust in something as like belligerently toxic as like Overeaters Anonymous, which is like super saturated with like restriction rhetoric, right? And like even then I was like, this ain't it. Like 4 months in, I was like, no. Mm-mm. Like my perfectionism is crazy right now. I gotta go, you know? But like the willingness to trust anything that wasn't my eating disorder as I knew it to be was enough to be like, I can't live like this.
That's amazing to me, Kate, that in your 20s, like your early 20s, you were aware enough of the differentiation between, all right, this is just perpetuating my eating disorder and I need the opposite or I need something different. Honestly, that's really amazing to me. I think it speaks to how emotionally mature a person you must be because, wow. I like to ask, because I'm so curious because it's been very true in my life, is as you stepped away from, you know, outright being the good fatty, probably conforming to societal norms, all this kind of bullshitty stuff that we do as fat people to kind of hide that we're fat. As you stopped that and started moving towards a more liberatory perspective, like what happened? How did it impact the people around you, friends, family? Like what was that part like?
It was interesting because a lot of people in my chosen family were kind of like, yeah, you know, like you're teaching me so much on this, like thank you, like, you know, like just like a radical receptiveness that. And then there was like a lot of, interestingly, like the places where I felt the most resistance were in my chosen career path, education, you know. And I would bring books at first I was, you know, as any educator starts, like substituting, you know, like just like the grunt work of education. And on periods when I wasn't subbing in class, I would be reading a lot. So one of the books I brought to work to read, like just in the faculty lounge, whatever, was Body Respect. And I was reading it and someone was asking me about it. And I was telling them sort of the premise. And I remember so distinctively, like, having them laugh in my face about like social determinants of health. And I was just like, I do not belong.
I mean, to just laugh in your face. Fuck, that's not cool. Yeah. And social determinants of health, like that's, I don't know. That doesn't feel like a stretch to me, but I guess I don't know. It is. It is for a lot of people. I know I have the same.
That said so much about, like, you know, like that's completely the exact place where fat phobia rests, is like the pick yourself up by your bootstraps. It's your own fault if you are this way.
Everything's in your control and your responsibility. Yep.
Yeah. So it's not all, to me now, knowing what I know now, it's not all that shocking. Because we are in a place where we blame poor people for being poor. We say, you know, oh, well, you know, we have all these programs that safeguard people of color and like give them opportunities. No, we don't, because we just obliterated affirmative action. you know, so it's like, we don't actually, And we have systemic issues that need addressing. And we can't until, and unless and until we admit that anti-fatness is one of them. So, you know, it's all of the same beast.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you, so you were going through this journey, deepening, you're subbing. I imagine at some point you get a full-time teacher role. And then at what point and what courage did it require to start to want to bring in this message of anti-diet into the school system?
So, my teaching journey took a long time, especially because of certification process and the field being saturated and waiting for people to enter and exit and retire and stuff like that. And I did leave replacements and stuff like that, here and there, and then finally landed something. Yes. But, here and there, I would actually teach, in high school when I was in a high school program, the poetry of Rachel Wiley, who is just amazing. And one of the ways that I would often talk about her work is by teaching kids what hypervisibility is, right? And we would talk about, her specifically, I always teach her poem, The Fat Joke, about medical fat phobia, her trip to the doctor's office and what that looks, sounds, and feels like. And before even kind of touching the poem, I would point out to the kids, this is a spoken word piece, because on paper, it would hit really hard, right? But watching her is really important because you get to see a fat person be fat and hear them be unapologetic about it. And also, she's doing nothing to make you comfortable with who she is intentionally, right? So, but also you can't, it's that whole notion that we do to fat people of you can't miss them, right? But simultaneously, that's the point. And so you have to watch this person be there, but in the society in which we live, they can't be avoided, right? So they're made invisible, but they're hyper visible all at once. So talking about not just the poem itself and the piece, but the politics of existing in the identity that she does, is something that I do often with fat authors, in the English classroom.
Well, and I love that you brought this to high school kids and high school. I don't know about your high school experience, but my high school experience was very much all about trying not to stand out, trying to fully conform in every way possible to, these, beauty and diet culture standards that have been set. And here you are emphasizing and contradicting some of their notions. How was this received by high school kids? Did they get it?
It's really interesting because I think so often, and now that I'm in middle school, I've actually done the same thing in middle school. I brought this to my eighth grader too, and did a sort of a middle schoolified iteration of it. But kids are so I don't want to say the wrong thing, and but some of them do take that risk, and then the cool part about that risk is that they trust you to help them work it out, right? Because then I'm asking them, what do you mean by, or where did we talk about health in this poem, right? But we're what abouting health here and all that stuff that goes into talking about someone's size. So it invites those conversations in sort of on purpose so that kids can ask the questions that they'd be afraid to ask in a situation where they're I don't want to step on anyone's toes or offend anybody. And it's no, we'll do that. But what you understand about being in this space is that no one's humanity is on the line, even if you ask a question that feels really hard.
Well, what you're doing so beautifully is countering the white supremacist principle of that keeps people from actually being in the mess of these conversations, because these conversations are messy. No one gets, I mean, oppression is messy. And if we're so scared of getting it wrong, then we avoid the conversations. And this happens all the time, right? Whether it's about racism or ableism or fatness or whatever. And I love that you're just creating this space, which, yeah, in opposition to that white supremacist construct that wants to keep us not having these conversations. What a gift. Like, that's amazing to me that you're doing that.
An earlier conversation that you and I had too, is that like so many educators have countered me, even saying like, well, you know, like talking about BMI and health and weight and size, like, isn't your lane because you're an English teacher, right? And because like they perceive that as being like the health phys ed department's job. And it's like, no. I teach literacy, right? I teach kids how to read. And like visual concepts and like how to read for truth are part of that, right? Because if you're teaching them how to read, quote, read a nutrition label, and you're not telling them that the FDA, right, and you're in Canada, so you don't have the FDA, but you might have something similar. The FDA is allowed to put a 20% margin of error on every food label that they print. Then you're not telling them the truth, and you're not teaching them critical literacy skills. So that's where I have to fill in what teachers neglected to do, and there's gaps here. So that's why, like, I don't see this work as siloed, because it can't be, right? And like, it shouldn't have to be like, I taught them this truth because another teacher did not. It should be like, I worked with you to show them that people's voices matter, because we should all collectively be teaching them that size diversity is part of diversity. So it's, you know, there's no lane for teaching people about how to have a collective sense of humanity. And we've not yet come to a place where people's size and weight is part of that.
So true. Yeah. When it makes me think about how, and I know this is so under attack in all over all sorts of different parts of the US, but how anti-racism and racism is taught in schools. I mean, the root of anti-fatness is intricately connected with racism and the construct of racism. And so, like, do you talk to kids about that as well? Like, how does that show up in your work?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, that to me is like as fundamental, like fundamentally included as like grammar instruction, you know, like that's like a no-brainer. But it's like selling, teaching weight stigma is like something that I have to introduce as like important. And that still feels really weird.
Yeah, that it's that you have to pitch it as like, oh, hey, don't forget about this. Yeah. I mean, it's so true. I mean, this comes up all the time when I talk to people about, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion work. And I've done a million classes with different DEI specialists for my own learning. I've interviewed a few people, and it's always like, okay, where's size? Why is sizeism not listed in your list of oppressions? It's still not considered, even by, you know, quote unquote experts in the field.
And it's not like, you know, I hate to play that game of like, well, the whataboutism, because it's like when we do that, people run under the assumption that like you're removing attention from anti-blackness and ableism and, you know, anti-queerness. And it's like, no. What I'm saying is they're all up there together.
Yeah. Like there's room for all of them.
Yeah. So like when we stop siloing the work, which is again a function of anti-Black white supremacy, is that everything has to be done in columns and can't be done in integrated collective community, then we actually can get to work.
Yes. Oh my God. Kate, you're brilliant. Okay. I want to hear about, as you're doing this work in your classrooms, pushback from parents, other teachers, like what happens? Like, what are some of the barriers, the roadblocks? Have you ever been called out for teaching this stuff? Like, I'm just, yeah, no, good.
I've never been called out. It's never been either here nor there. Like, I've never been called out. I've never been praised. It's always just been like, oh, I don't get to teach that. Good for you. And I'm like, okay. Or I'll get the very, like, I'm taking a deep breath because
oh no, everyone take a breath.
The, like, former fat, I lost 3 digits worth of pounds. I used to be fat, so I get it. And I'm like, you don't, because you have thin privilege now. you know, like, pouring out of, like, solidarity from someone who, like, is not politically fat. I'll just put it that way. You know, where it's like, no, you shed the oppression that I still have. And good for you if that's what you want. But don't try to cling to something that no longer exists for you because you have been privileged. But it's like, it's so bizarre because and I just finished this chapter in the Thin Kid Privilege chapter in Fat Talk, as I'm saying this, but like, you know, it's something, thin privilege is something that so many people chase, but so many newly thin people are so quick to abandon when they want to relate to a weight loss narrative. And it's like, you cannot have it both ways, right? Because you are not in the fight for liberation of fat people. You are the success story for the oppressor.
Yes. Yes. Oh, that's a hard truth for people.
Woo. Yeah. And, you know, I think, and like Virginia said it, and like I've said this as my working theory for a long time. I think there's it's a circle, right? It's a circle. Because in the faculty lounge, in the education system, right? In America, teaching is 80% women, 80% white women.
Is it that high?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. 80% white women.
And 80% white. And a majority of those white people are women. And now when you take those two threads, and you connect them to thin privilege, right? Like the misogyny of the invisible labor done by female education professionals. What are they trying to have in common in a society that is oppressing them for being women? The thing that they have is that they're trying not to be further oppressed by anti-fatness. You know, it's just like, so they perpetuate all of that against each other with comments like, oh, I'm going to kill whoever brought the cookies in from their party this weekend. Why did they bring that here? I don't want to eat that. Then don't.
But why does it have to be so, all the commentary?
Right. But it's a solidarity with, you know, like the world outside does not value my labor. So I have to take it out on the one thing that makes sense to me, which is like the perpetuation of diet culture and fanning the flames of being anti-fat in the space that it's been made safe to do so, which is the
It just, as you're describing it, I'm like, wow, it really becomes about a way to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty high stakes.
Right. Because once you do that, you have something in common with people. And once people, like I have been in every educational space that I've ever participated in, starting with being laughed at for reading a book about diet culture being BS, right?
Hello, Fat Joy friend. I'm popping into this episode to give you an exciting update. Fat Joy is now ranked in the top 2%, 2% of all 3.4 million global podcasts, which is a really big deal. You may have heard, because I've been talking about it, that I am aiming for this podcast to hit the top 1%. And you can help the podcast get there by making sure you've subscribed to the podcast and giving us a 5-star rating. And if you want to be a little extra, I love extra. If you've gotten something out of these episodes, if they've supported you in some way, please write a review for the podcast. I love these. I put them all on the website. They mean so much when they come in. No surprise, I believe that fat stories are worth telling, and I am so grateful to bring you a new story each week and honored that you keep coming back to listen. So thank you, lovely, and enjoy the rest of the episode.
Every space I've ever been in, I've refused to participate in the oppressive solidarity of anti-fatness as white supremacy culture. And I've been looked at like I was insane. And so I've always been known as like that person who won't participate in the discussion if it's going on in that regard, and like sort of like on the outs in that frame. And I stopped caring.
I was just going to ask how do you manage that? Like, that's a hard thing, to feel that sense of not belonging in certain scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just a matter of like, I think people in spaces like that, like bodies are visible, right? And like small fat is where I sort of sit in that conversation, but I sit with it visibly and then verbally articulate no desire to change that. And I think that throws people for a loop.
Oh yeah, they don't know what to do with that.
You know? So it's like, but like, what can you say? Like, there's nothing to say.
No.
Because like, what you reveal if you come back at me is like, you're playing sidewalk doctor, because you don't actually know me enough to care about my health. So, and I like it that way, you know, like we're at work. You're not my friend. So.
Yeah. So what led to, because you created the hashtag Ditching Diet Culture at School. What led to that, and what does that encompass? Tell people a little bit about that.
So the goal of that, you know, true to my roots as a literacy teacher, I love when I can find things in one place, and like, I love curating just like all the things that have helped me. A lot of the, like when I was in early recovery, I listened to like weeks worth of podcasts. And they saved me in a lot of ways. So like, I just started finding the links and putting them on there, and then like books and stuff and putting them on there. And then the goal really became to, you know, start and sustain conversations about anti-fatness and weight stigma in educational spaces so that they can lead to fat liberation. And not in the sense that like, unfortunately, that it's taken somewhat of a, it's occupied some space in that, like, again, you know, and it's reflective of like, this is who is teaching, so this is who's going to be representing it, is thin white educators are sort of reading and absorbing all these books by Hayes dietitians and, you know, different like really mainstreamed Instagram influencer registered dietitians who are intuitive eating coaches and whatever, and turnkeying it for folks. And it's like, that is sort of not, you know, if you're doing that, please know that, like, you have to be really mindful of who's in the room, because you could be walking over the fat folks who could be at the front, right? So, like, unfortunately, a lot of what we saw in 2020 with people reading, you know, Ibram X. Kendi and Leila Saad and purchasing up all of the books about anti-racism and then suddenly being experts about DEI because they found a reason to care about it when they should have all along, are doing the same thing now with diet culture and anti-fatness, right? They've gotten a hold of maintenance phase. They've gotten a hold of Aubrey Gordon, and all of a sudden they know what they're talking about and they can read a book and present it to their district or their, you know, their PLC, which is professional learning community in the teaching world, and walk away feeling really good about themselves. But then the people in the district or the space with a fat politic are like, I've been saying this and living it for my whole life and no one's listened to me. Why are they listening to a person who has all the privilege in the world and doesn't have to live in the oppression and the experience that I do? And that's especially grating, you know, I can only imagine, for fat Black women, for fat queer people. And speaking as a fat queer person, but like for fat Black queer people, and like if you have multiple marginalities, like, how much more annoying it is to have people with the most privilege suddenly be able to speak on.
And get compensation for.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Right? So we have that dynamic going for us as well. And like the diet culture money game is no exception to that. Like, so it's like, we want that conversation to be happening in DEI, of course, but the people doing it should be the people who are experiencing the harm,
yes,
of it not happening in the first place.
Yes.
Because ultimately it trickles down to the fattest kids,
yes,
who are harmed by the policies that the fat adults were harmed by first.
Yes. So let's talk about kids. Like, as you're having these conversations, expanding their minds, is the work that you're doing getting into actual, like, mainstream curriculum, or is it you as an individual are doing this? Like, how does this get spread? How does this happen more?
I make it a point to, you know, not just for the visibility of like fat authors, I make it a point to like show my kids who all authors are in my classroom. Like if we're reading a poem, I'll be like, here's a picture of the person that we're reading about right now. We're reading a piece from right now. But I mean, in the space that I've entered, we have a lot of really awesome, like, flexibility with classroom library stuff. And we have a really awesome, like, literacy media person who gets us books every year, or like gets us, you know, stuff for books every year, and like is always really on top of like books with size diverse voices. Like, she ordered me a copy of Angie Manfredi's anthology last year. She always orders me anything new by Crystal Maldonado. If there's a book that you know about, like, please let me know. Last year, the sixth grade put Starfish into their book clubs about power. So they're talking about not just, you know, like the basic, like, oh, kindness, anti-bullying, because that's what we do to fat stories too. It's like, oh, you know, if you just lost weight, people stop bullying you. It's like, no, if we stop having anti-fat culture and beliefs in society, people would stop bullying each other. But no, they made it. They put Starfish in a unit about power and who has power and who doesn't, and what fat phobia looks like in the context of power. So more meaningful.
The grade sixes chose to do that themselves?
So the teachers put together a book club and they put starfish in the book club option for the kids, and they took it on. So,
well, I mean, Kate, that gives me hope for our world. Oh, I love that. You had mentioned before we started recording that you also get asked to consult, like people, like other teachers. Now, again, unpaid labor, which is something we should also talk about. But because I just keep thinking about, like, how does this spread? How does it get built into curriculum? How do we stop doing assignments in elementary school about, okay, take a junk food and make it healthy? Like when do we just stop all that bullshit? Like, what's the answer, Kate?
You know, it's funny because it's like coming up on a year anniversary where I made a Twitter post about stop assigning food diaries to kids, and it got like 50,000 likes, and so many people had things to say about it. But like the ones that I actually paid attention to, and it was double-sided, let me tell you something. It was people quite literally said, like, you know, based on my profile picture, which is my school photo, by the way, of me and my double chin, you know, because of my size, like, I have no business teaching. That was one comment. But most of the commentary was like, yes, please stop doing that. This was the roadmap to my eating disorder. And I was like, see? So, you know, I mean, anecdotally, the proof is there, right? So, you know, that just invigorated and reaffirmed and accidentally made viral the work that I do. In ways that really, I was like, oh my God, yeah, we have a problem. And it was not just the United States either. So it was like an international, like, cry for help among a lot of people who were like, yeah, this jump started my disordered eating problem when people graded my food intake. And, you know, of course, there's like the whole, like, and Virginia rails against elimination diets. Like, and there's a whole, like, medical, you know, like, if you're doing it for reasons under supervision of a professional, like, that's one thing. But, like, putting it in for a grade is not the same conversation. Like, people were trying to have conversations that were not part of the conversation. And I was like, no, but a teacher who is not a qualified health professional should not be telling you. And like, and I was like, but like, I was like, you know what? Like, okay, like this whole thread is not just about health anymore. It's about kids don't know, or people don't know, because those people who were in the replies were former children, went to school at some point, right? Weren't taught how to debate in good faith, right? So there's my job. I'm an English teacher, right? Rhetoric. My job. So, you know, like, it's all of our job.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever gotten comments from parents? We haven't talked about parents yet.
Mm-mm.
No.
No. No.
That's great.
Yeah. I think it's like, you know, I work and teach in a fairly, like, progressive area for the most part, so to speak. So it's like, you know, people, if you level with them about, like, why those are interconnected, they're like, that makes sense. So for the most part, and I mean, like, it's simultaneously, like, very progressive, but also, like, there's a lot of, like, privilege at play. So, I mean, at the very minimum, like, there's an invitation to talk about their, like, you know, like, the concept of, like, well, you know, worrying about health in a general sense isn't really a problem in this zip code because people have access to healthcare and they're not having toxic waste dumped in their yards because don't have that issue here, you know, and like environmental pollutants aren't obesogenic in this neighborhood and stuff like that. So it's like that is at least very level. And it's like, you know, what I love about the space that I'm in is that like, if you can back things with data, people will support. So it's like, no. Like I have the science to support that. You know, and they'll be like, okay.
Kate, for teachers who are listening, so I know there are lots of teachers listening, and for parents, of course, there are lots of parents listening. Like, what, let's start with teachers. If teachers wanted to bring a more anti-diet culture approach into their classrooms, into their schools, like any tips, where should they start? What should they do? What would you tell them?
I think like, you know, start where I started is just like untangling the ideas about fat and even just the word that kids picked up, that you picked up, that we all picked up. Like I have a couple teachers in my area who I'm working with right now who are using the Harvard implicit bias test, and they took the pictures of the five people and their different bodies, and it's just the silhouettes. And it's like, you know, they're asking kids, like, which person do you think is the healthiest? And they're asking kids to unpack, like, why they think that, right? And, like, even just starting, like, there, or, like, why we assume that thinness equals health, or, like, where we got, like, the origin story of those ideas, right? So, like, in English, you can even write that. Like, what is the origin story of why you think fat has a negative connotation, AP language word, right? So there's so many different arenas to begin, across subject areas, across grade levels, across content, that can lead to really meaningful conversation to break this down. But, you know, I always, and again, it goes back to like, don't turnkey it till you're ready to do it. Don't do this work until you've done it in
yourself. Kate is pointing to her chest. Yeah. Do it in your own heart first. Yeah.
Yeah. Do it in your own heart, in your own head, in your own soul. Because if you're not, and that's not, it doesn't happen after reading one book by one person, right? Especially like the person or people that we've tokenized as like the voice for anti-fat stuff. You need a diversity of even those voices to figure this out. But like turnkeying it to kids too soon, especially unwinding hundreds of years of work that has worked against fat people to harm us, can actually end up doing more harm than good, especially if you're in the business of teaching the youth of America or anywhere.
Yeah. That's so, so useful. And then parents. I mean, you must interact with a lot of parents. Like anything that you would want to share or tell parents?
First and foremost, read Virginia Soul Smith's new book, Fat Talk, Parenting the Age.
I'm going to link to it in the notes for sure.
It, like, I interact with adolescents 10 months out of the year. And, like, I don't have children of my own. But, like, it has healed me as a kid who was parented by a lot of diet culture philosophy in like more ways than I can even count in just like half the book thus far. And so like, if you want to heal yourself and then help heal your child, I highly recommend this book. And then also, I think this extends more than just to women, but, What's Eating Us by Cole Kasdan. It's women, food, and the epidemic of body anxiety. I think that's the whole title. I could be wrong about a couple, mincing a couple words there, but it's just an excellent, excellent short text. It's like memoir nonfiction. She infuses her own eating disorder recovery with like here's why diet culture is evil and terrible and ruining everything.
Excellent. I'll link to that as well. And I'm not familiar with that one, so I think I'm going to get that for myself too.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Yeah. What was the author again?
Cole Kasdan.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Those are great. Again, and I imagine the same thing as with teachers, which is like, we have to start doing it. We have to do our own work first before we can like talk to our kids about it and, you know, kind of, yeah, uncover our own non-consensual learning via diet culture, unlearn that stuff. Yeah, amazing. I mean, Kate, I can just imagine the impact you're having in your classroom. And I think those kids are so freaking lucky. Like you said, I was thinking back, if I had had one person, whether it be a family member or a teacher, say that my body was okay, I really think it could have shifted my belief system. Because I remember other things that teachers especially said, and they did shift in different ways, like non-related, like, oh, you're like, my English lit teacher was what gave me, like, said something to me that I've never forgotten. You know, it's like that kind of stuff. And it was about, like, I was a good writer. But, like, if someone had said something about me actually being okay in my body, I really wonder what that could have, how that could have changed how I went forward from that point on, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, that's what it is fat kids are always, you're a good writer. You have such a pretty face. You're a really good actress. You know, it's never like you're okay as you are.
Right. My literal affirmation every day that, and I'm like 10 years into doing this work with lots of therapy, lots of reading, literally still every day I have to say to myself, I am worthy exactly as I am. Because for decades, I was told different. And so now I'm like, but I have to say that to myself every day. I'm worthy exactly as I am. I have nothing to prove. I'm safe. I'm loved. Like, yeah. So pass those messages on, people. Kate, I want to turn to joy. So what connects you to joy? I'm so curious. I'm starting to get really curious because I've had a few conversations recently with people about like, what even is your concept of joy? Like, what do you think joy is? And then how do you engage with it?
It's so funny. My concept of joy is just, it exists in like, this is going to sound so weird, but like it exists in like hearing other people feel happy. You know, like sometimes when I'm like during the school year, when I'm at work and I'm teaching and like, or like I'll be like taking attendance or something and like I'll hear kids like laughing or saying something like really funny. And like last year, my kids were like so hilarious. So I like wrote down some of the stuff that they said, like on a piece of paper next to my desk, and I have like a wall of quotes by the end of the year. But like, I would like sit there and just like candidly like listen to some of the stuff they said and just be cracking up at my desk. And like, they would be like doing their work and then someone would note, I have like my kid, like around the school, I'm known for my laugh. So they would hear me laughing, like they would finally like stop their work and like hear me laughing. And they'd be like, what are you doing? Like, what's so funny? And they'd be like, oh my God. So like hearing and being in the presence of other people, just like making each other happy, my joy, right? Like, especially when it's around just like people who don't even know how funny they are.
The unintentional, yeah.
Accidentally funny people are my favorite.
So true. So true. Oh, I love that. Well, Kate, thank you. This has been so wonderful to talk to you and learn about the work that you're doing. I have tons of links to share in the episode notes. And how can people stay connected to you?
So I am on Instagram, Twitter, which is X now, I guess, and threads at just teaching ELA.
Okay, perfect. And I'll include that in the show notes as well. Oh, you're delightful, Kate. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the world. Before we go, I'd like to read a poem, because poetry can reach our hearts in a different way. Poems can have us feel in a different way. And that's what this podcast is all about. Expanding our hearts, deepening our empathy, and inviting in joy. So each week, you get a new poem. For this episode with Kate, I wanted to find a poem that captures the audacity of trying to change diet culture in our schools. God, it's so embedded. So I picked one of my favorite poems, which is by Ada Limon, and it's called How to Triumph Like a Girl. I like the lady horses best, how they make it all look easy, like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger. After winning, ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies. As if this big, dangerous animal is also a part of me. That somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart, giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge, beating, genius machine that thinks, no, it knows it's gonna come in first? Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely, I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly Fat Joy day, and we'll talk again soon.